Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. The end of the Cold War, marked by the collapse of the Iron Curtain and the dismantling of the Soviet Union, was hailed by one scholar as the end of history. Well, history goes on, and the Cold War itself has become one of its major subjects. In a moment, we'll revisit aspects of that struggle between the West and the Soviet Union with Professor Roger Kennett. But before we do that, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. During this week, in 1929, civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. was born in Atlanta, Georgia. Introduced to the African-American social gospel as a child by his minister uncle, the young King witnessed firsthand the racial discrimination and economic hardships blacks faced in the segregated South. He attended Morehouse University, Crozier Theological Seminary, and Boston University, where he earned his doctorate in systematic theology. He was ordained a Baptist minister, but was drawn into the civil rights movement of the 1950s. King started in the South, but he soon became a national figure. In 1955, he led a protest against the arrest of Rosa Parks, who refused to give up her seat to a white person while riding a Montgomery bus. In 1963, he became president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and led a march on Washington of over 250,000 people, where at the Lincoln Memorial, he gave his most memorable speech, "I Have a Dream." By 1968, many Americans, black and white, applauded King's nonviolent approach to social protest. Some whites, however, thought he was dangerous, while more radical blacks insisted that he was not militant enough. We'll never know who was right, what King's method of protest would have ultimately accomplished, because later that year he was killed by James Earl Ray in Memphis, Tennessee. Turning to history in the news, a study comparing the DNA of people around the world has yielded the best evidence yet to support the out-of-Africa theory, which suggests that modern humans first evolved in Africa and scattered to populate the planet as recently as 50,000 years ago. Advocates of the rival multi-regional theory say modern humans evolved simultaneously in Africa, Europe, and Asia, and from multiple early humans. The study appeared in the December issue of the journal Nature. Less open to conjecture is the observation that despite having Mel Gibson for a star, the Revolutionary Era epic The Patriot was a box office failure. According to historian Joseph Ellis, this is to be expected because accounts of the American Revolution never do well at the box office compared to the Civil War. He offered two possible explanations. First, the American Revolution was pre-photographs, so we are denied the compelling dramatic images of photographers like Matthew Brady. Second, we have so enshrined the major figures and events of the American Revolution that we have rendered them lifeless and uninteresting. The American Revolution, Ellis explains, is so patriotic as to seem inevitable, hardly lending itself to great drama. You're listening to Talking History. The Cold War is history. It's also part of the memory of the nation. And is often the case, no matter what the subject, public memory commonly consists of errors in fact, misconceptions, and myths. Here to help us sort out fact from fiction on the Cold War is Talking History's Terry Clark.
The last half of the 20th century was dominated by the Cold War, a period of intense competition between the two superpowers. The Cold War conjures up images of nuclear stalemate, frequent crises, and proxy wars in the Third World. Here to offer us a different perspective on the Cold War is Professor Roger Kennett. Dr. Kennett is a professor in the School of International Studies at the University of Miami and co-editor of the book, The Cold War as Cooperation. Welcome to our show, Professor Kennett.
Very nice to be with you.
Let me start by asking you, there is this popular perception of the Cold War as a very dangerous time. Could you elaborate on that for us a little bit?
Well, obviously, from one perspective, it was. Both superpowers had thousands of nuclear weapons targeted on one another. Both were involved in a variety of activities that seemingly competed with one another. But on the other hand, from about the beginning of the 1960s on, they had agreed not formally agreed, but agreed in practice, to set a ground rules that kept the conflict and the confrontation in some type of control. There was not the kind of unlimited conflict that was likely to lead to a nuclear confrontation after, I would say, 1961, the Berlin Wall.
Now, that brings us to the thesis of your book, because you talk about the lessening of the probability of some sort of full nuclear engagement, but you talk about it within the perspective of a cooperation. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, in a way, we selected that title because it was jazzy, but it also had a substantial degree of accuracy. From the 1960s on, the U.S. and the Soviet Union conducted much of its competition actually through proxies. Each side had a variety of friends and allies to whom they provided support. However, neither the U.S. nor the Soviet Union permitted these proxies and allies to go too far, lest the competition on a regional basis, whether we're talking about the Middle East or sub-Saharan Africa, get out of hand. So that's the gist of the argument. The argument is that despite the global competition, despite the confrontation that existed and did realistically exist, there was general recognition both in Moscow and in Washington that this competition had to be reined in, that dependencies and allies could not be permitted to initiate conflicts that might well get out of hand, with the result that a regional conflict could flare up and expand into some kind of a global war between the two major superpowers. So that's the gist of the argument. And the book, which is a collective effort, it wasn't just me, it was I did this with a number of other specialists on the Soviet Union, there was general agreement that the model made sense. Already in the 1950s, the U.S. was unwilling to intervene actively in Central Europe, in large part because such intervention would have confronted the Soviet Union and likely led to a nuclear disaster. In the Middle East, throughout the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, there's very clear evidence of both the U.S. and the Soviet Union holding tight the reins on their respective allies in the region to prevent conflict from getting out of hand. The Cuban Missile Crisis of 1961 was, I believe, the last major confrontation that had a real probability or a high probability of leading to a nuclear confrontation. After that, but one or other side backed down or didn't even engage in the kind of direct competitive relationship in almost every other conflict, and whether we're talking about Soviet involvement in sub-Saharan Africa or in Afghanistan, the U.S. was willing to operate on the edges but not willing to intervene directly lest things get out of hand in the relationship with the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm. So if I understand correctly, then you're suggesting that there was some evolution of what rules of the game between
yes.
the two great superpowers?
Yes.
Yeah. What are some of the major turning points? You talked about the Cuban Missile Crisis. Were there other major turning points at which though?
My own view is Berlin in 1949, the Berlin crisis of 1949, the airlift. Already then, there were certain rules that were being followed. Then in the 1950s, with the Soviet intervention in Hungary to reimpose control, the U.S. backed off despite rhetoric to the contrary. Between 1952 and 1956, the U.S., the first Eisenhower administration, implied that it was going to roll back the Iron Curtain. That, in effect, did not occur when the opportunity arose, and the clear reason was U.S. intervention would have been a war with the Soviet Union. Then the next major one, I think, was the Cuban Missile Crisis. All of us involved in this project agreed that by 1962 or 63, that's after the Cuban Missile Crisis, the kind of rules of the game that we were talking about were generally in place.
What about the 1968 Cuban Missile, not Cuban Missile, the 1968 events in Czechoslovakia? What role, did they play any role in this evolution of understanding?
By then, I believe the general rules were in place, and the United States and the West more generally, NATO, really did nothing to confront the Soviet Union. Once the Soviets, yes, there had been efforts during spring and summer of 1968 to support those who were reformers, but once the Soviets intervened, there was no possibility of a Western military reaction.
What about, and I have to ask this one, obviously, Afghanistan invasion 1979?
Once again, a serious challenge to the status quo, at least as interpreted from the side of the West. But there was no likelihood of a direct U.S. involvement. Yes, the U.S. did, over the course of the 1980s, begin to provide support to those who were challenging Soviet domination, just as the Soviets in the 1960s and early 70s had supported Vietnam in its war with the United States, but no direct involvement in those confrontations. For the same reasons that I was arguing earlier, a direct U.S. involvement would have very possibly meant confrontation.
Most of us view the Cold War as a very dangerous nuclear stalemate. And given your perspective, it seems you come to a different conclusion on that. Just how dangerous was the Cold War?
Well, it was obviously very dangerous. Miscalculations, technical lapses, all of these things could have led to a real exchange. But I believe that from the middle 60s on, it was after the Cuban Missile Crisis, there was serious effort and recognition both in Moscow and in Washington that nuclear war meant disaster. Disaster not only for the enemy, but disaster for oneself. And although the capacity was there and miscalculations could have triggered a nuclear exchange, major efforts were taken, I believe, to ensure that this not get out of hand and that kind of exchange and mutual disaster not occur.
Now,
but the psychological environment, one final point, the psychological environment obviously was one of mutual destructive capacity, assured destruction of the enemy, and both sides tended to downplay the fact that destruction of the enemy also very likely meant destruction of oneself.
The Cold War ended with the collapse of one of the superpowers, in this case the Soviet Union, 1991. When that occurred, you heard a number of Americans and certainly our politicians declaring that we had won that engagement. We had won the Cold War. Who won the Cold War?
I don't think anyone won the Cold War. I would argue that Soviet policy changed primarily from the inside out, not primarily as a result of U.S. military pressures, not as a result of Star Wars or projected Star Wars, but rather because Soviet elites, already beginning in the 50s and much more forcefully in the 60s and 70s, lost faith in the old ideology, did not believe the propaganda of the regime, recognized that confrontation with the West was a potential disaster in the long term. By 1985, a generation of Soviet intellectuals, academics, government officials, analysts who had been moving away from the kind of isolationist worldview that characterized Stalinism, these individuals came to power through Gorbachev. Gorbachev represented them, put them into key positions, and they began dramatic changes in 85, 86, 87. Now, they didn't work. They didn't work in the sense that they did not successfully reform the old system. But one of the central elements of this new thinking, to use Gorbachev's term, was that superpower confrontation simply would result in global disaster, that there were many, many issues of compatibility between the long-term interests of the Soviet Union and the United States. So that I would argue that it was internal change, internal learning, that made the changes and not external pressures. All of the external pressures were occurring within the context of this kind of an environment.
You're talking about external pressures. What about...
From the United States.
Right. I frequently hear the thesis that there were external pressures created, though, by the Reagan military buildup. What is your take on that?
That did occur. But this occurred within the context of a process that was well underway, a process of value change, if you will, a new world, a changing world perspective. And the U.S. military buildup that began in the late 1970s already probably speeded up the process, some of the economic difficulties the Soviets had in maintaining a competitive position with the U.S. They may have speeded that process up, but I would argue they didn't cause the process.
None of these decisions you're talking about, though, none of them were intended to see the Soviet Union come to an end.
Oh, absolutely not.
Yeah. Well, why did the country collapse?
Very briefly, to repeat, the set of economic and political problems got out of control. The leadership was not able to bring decisive policies to bear on many of these issues. And by summer of 1991, there were strong political forces that were, in effect, resulting in demands for greater and greater autonomy at the local, at the regional, at the provincial level. And that all culminated in the fall after an aborted coup attempt in August of 1991. But in the fall of 1991, the leadership of the three Slavic republics decided that they were going to break away from the old Soviet Union. But the key thing was the inability to implement effective policies that solved real problems, and the fact that opening the political doors for discussion and debate was important in Gorbachev's losing control of the political process.
Professor Cannon, I thank you for being our guest today.
I'm very pleased to have been with you.
You have been listening to Professor Roger Cannon, professor in the School of International Studies at the University of Miami.
Students Gone Wild is the way one national television network describes its coverage of college students at spring break. Many would add it covers students on campus for the rest of the year as well, picturing them as partying to excess. Maybe, maybe not. But even if it were true, were college students, say, 150 years ago, any different? Here to give us the results of his research into that subject is Robert Pace. Pace is a professor of history at McMurray University in Abilene, Texas, where he is completing work on a history of college students in the Old South.
College represents a unique life experience for those who are living it. But in addition to devoting themselves to their studies, college students also occasionally indulge in animal house-type behavior. But has it always been so? Well, college students in the Old South behaved in ways that would fill several Hollywood scripts. Numerous accounts tell us that between 1800 and 1860, these wealthy sons of the Southern white elite spent much of their spare time not only with drinking, gambling, and dancing, but also with frolicking. Examples of this behavior abound. At the University of Alabama, students pushed a calf to the apex of the university rotunda's dome and then tied it in place. At the University of Mississippi, visitors often found that their horses' tails had been cut off by mischievous students. And at Virginia's Washington College, students disassembled a wagon, then reassembled it inside the chapel and filled it with firewood. What was significantly different about college life in the Old South, however, was that for these young men to become part of the adult world, they had to join and support the Southern Code of Honor. This is not the concept of honor most of us understand today, one where justice and ethical behavior rule. Honor in the Old South consisted of a set of rules that advanced the appearance of duty, pride, and power. In other words, being viewed as a man of substance was more important than being a man of substance. So in this world, college students could sow their oats as long as they appeared to maintain the role of the Southern gentleman. In the classroom, this often meant cheating was acceptable. One father even mailed a newspaper article to his son and urged the boy to read the piece for a public speech he was being asked to prepare. As the father put it, plagiarism is superior to the appearance of dunceism every time. This level of expectation, however, also led to danger in Southern colleges. Southern gentlemen had to defend their honor with their lives. This meant that innocent pranks could often move quickly to deadly duels. In 1848, University of Alabama student Edward Baptist had to withdraw from college because he thought he had challenged a friend to a fistfight. The friend believed he had been challenged to a duel. Had Baptist remained and not fought, his honor would have been ruined. And in 1840, University of Virginia professor A.G. Davis also found out about the dangers of the Southern Code when he literally tried to unmask a student who was firing a pistol into the night air. Davis lost his life that night. In looking at college students today, we know that they have pressures and concerns that their antebellum Southern predecessors never would have imagined. But it is also clear that as today's students navigate the course between classes, homecoming, and the next party, the honor codes to which they subscribe are also different than the code of honor that ruled the Old South.
You've been listening to Robert Pace, professor of history at McMurray University. This is Talking History. American presidential inaugurals are spectacular events, watched by millions of people not only from the United States, but from around the world. This year's will be no different. Inaugurations have a very interesting history, which you can learn about at a special website created for you by the Library of Congress. Here to tell you about the site is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
A collection containing materials from all United States presidential inaugurations is now available on the Library of Congress American Memories website at www.loc.gov. I Do Solemnly Swear is a presentation of 400 items from each inauguration from George Washington to William Jefferson Clinton. It will include items from George W. Bush's inauguration when the material is available. Included in the collection are diaries, letters, photographs, programs, and sheet music that document the ceremonial aspects of presidential inaugurations. The handwritten drafts of the inaugural addresses provide a glimpse at how these speeches were crafted. This new collection has been added to the 90 already available from the American Memory, a project of the National Digital Program of the Library of Congress. Visit the Library of Congress website for a look at presidential inaugurations and much, much more in the American Memory Project.
Turning to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, We call to your attention three PBS television specials that will air at the beginning of February for Black History Month. From Swastika to Jim Crow, scheduled for February 1st, presents the largely unknown story of two cultures brought together by the tragic circumstances of war and discrimination. In the 1930s, Jewish intellectuals who escaped Nazi Germany and immigrated to the United States confronted anti-Semitism in the nation's colleges and universities. Many took teaching positions at traditionally black colleges in the South, where they formed lasting friendships with students and other faculty. On February 2nd, watch for Ralph Bunche, An American Odyssey, which chronicles the legacy of the first African-American and the first person of color to win the Nobel Peace Prize. And on February 8th, Going to Chicago will tell the story of the largest internal migration in American history, the move that led millions of African-Americans from the cotton fields of the rural South to the industrial cities of the North and West. Be sure to check your local listings for exact showtimes. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you will join us next week when we take a look at the cultural history of the Super Bowl. Until next time, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. From the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.